friendship and happiness insights from Aristotle and Aquinas. I'm mostly going to be introducing Aristotle's ideas about friendship and happiness because Aristotle is the philosophical foundation for Thomas Aquinas's theology. So I'm going to start off by going over Aristotle's ideas, and then I'm going to talk about how Aquinas appropriates those ideas within a Christian theological context. The way that I read Aquinas, he's taking Aristotle's view and making it do work that Aristotle could not make it do himself. The first thing that I want to note, because I think it's incredibly important and it's not often noted, is that Aristotle devotes more time to friendship than any other topic in the Nicomachean Ethics. The second thing that I want to note, because I think it's equally important, and you wouldn't, if you looked at contemporary work on Aristotle, on Aristotle's ethics in particular, and it wouldn't matter whether that contemporary work was historical or critical, so it wouldn't matter if you were reading Neo-Aristotelian virtue ethicists, or if you were reading historians who were writing about what Aristotle said, you wouldn't really realize that Aristotle spent more time in his ethical works talking about friendship than any other topic, because nobody talks about friendship. It's completely marginalized within contemporary ethics, contemporary philosophy. And it's even marginalized as a topic for people who work on Aristotle and Aristotle's ethics. So there's a question there. Why is this? Why doesn't anyone care about friendship? Is it that friendship and the love that exists between friends, is it unimportant? Is that the reason why it's completely ignored? Or is it because philosophers think that friendship and the love between friends is just sort of obvious? It's not worthy of philosophical attention. Or is it because certain assumptions, certain background assumptions made by contemporary philosophers and ethicists prevent them from seeing that friendship is in fact essential to a well-lived human life. And it prevents them from even seeing that this is surely the case for Aristotle. If you read, I mean, just to take an example, Sarah Brody has this really famous work of scholarship on Aristotle's ethics. I looked in the index. She mentions friendship four times. Three of those times are in a footnote. So it's really, I mean, it's like, wow, you would think that friendship just didn't matter for Aristotle. However, it did. In fact, it's arguably like the central concept of his ethical theory. So I want to start with a question about why is it so marginalized now? So for Aristotle, friendship is central to both his politics and his ethics. It's right at the heart of his theory. So I want to talk about why this is the case for Aristotle, and then I also hope that maybe we'll get to talk about whether or not this ought to be the case. You know, is Aristotle correct that friendship is at the heart of ethics? So first, I want to say something about the Nicomachean Ethics as a text. I'm not presuming that anyone has read it. The Nicomachean Ethics is his most influential, it's not his only work of ethics, but it's his most influential work in ethics. It's 10 books. The first thing that Aristotle tells us about ethics is that the study of ethics is not undertaken for the sake of knowledge. So it's unlike the theoretical sciences like metaphysics or physics or the science of the soul. Those sciences are undertaken for the sake of knowledge. But ethics is undertaken for the sake of being good and living well. And being good and living well for Aristotle are intimately connected. So one studies ethics in order to become a good person and live a happy life. You don't study ethics just for the sake of knowing something. So it's a practical science, not a theoretical science. And given that it's a practical science, the principal question for Aristotle, the question that he opens up the ethics with, is what's the highest good, right? So what is the good at which all of our practical thought and reasoning and action ought to aim? Because that will be the target, right, of our lives. We'll want to hit that. And in order to hit the target, we would have to know what it is, right? So what's the highest good? Aristotle calls this good eudaimonia. That's a Greek word. It's sometimes translated as blessedness or the blessed life. Sometimes it's translated as happiness. Sometimes it's just translated as living well. But the goal of the practical life is eudaimonia. And Aristotle thinks of such a life in terms of activity. So it's not like if you reach eudaimonia, you're in some kind of passive state or condition. It's a kind of activity. And for Aristotle, he establishes right away in book one that we must identify a eudaimon life with some exercise of characteristically human capacities. So the eudaimon life is going to have to be the exercise of capacities that are essential to the human, that like express the human in some unique way. And he thinks that these are our rational capacities. Our rational capacities are those capacities that make us live a uniquely or characteristically human kind of life. And basically, Aristotle spends the first three books of the Nicomachean Ethics trying to establish that eudaimonia is the highest good, that we're going to reach that through the exercise of our specifically rational capacities. So our capacity to know and understand what's true and to seek and realize what's good. And he establishes also that virtues are what's necessary for us in order to attain this end or this goal. So that's kind of book one. And then in book two, he's trying to establish, you know, what sort of characteristic a virtue is. One thing that is really important for Aristotle is that happiness, or the sort of activity that constitutes a eudaimon life, is virtuous activity. Okay, so we just always have to keep that in mind when we're talking about Aristotle. Now, this idea of happiness is one of the translations of eudaimonia. Today, when we talk about happiness, and especially when we theorize about happiness, so if you're theorizing about happiness in economics or in the social sciences, psychology, then you're basically talking about subjective well-being or feeling good. So everybody in the social sciences is a subjectivist about happiness. And that means that they reduce the concept of well-being to pleasure. So some of them are hedonists. Others of them think that subjective well-being is just when you have an overall balance of positive affect over negative affect, where this includes like all of your emotional life and your moods and everything else. And then other people will add to that some kind of subjective cognitive assessment that you're satisfied with your life on the whole. All of these views are still just subjectivism, because even in the case where you make some kind of cognitive assessment that you're satisfied with your life, that assessment is not subject to objective criteria. So if I say that, if I'm like part of some psychological study and they want me to give a self-report on my own happiness, which is how they measure it, then if I say that I'm so-and-so satisfied with my life, like I give it a 6 out of 10, it's not like someone's going to come to me and say, oh, but actually, you know, like your husband beats you all the time and you're poor, like you're not actually happy. That's not how it works. It's just like whatever I report about it, is just taken as the only obvious measure. Now, this kind of subjective well-being conception of happiness is not what Aristotle's talking about at all. The thing is, with all of these forms of subjectivism, you have two related problems from an Aristotelian perspective. So one, you have just a focus on an individual and an individual's psychology. So you have an isolated unit of assessment, and that's all that matters. You don't look at anything else. And you also have, and this is even more problematic from Aristotle's perspective, you have a kind of dualism or a divorce between the psychological perspective of the agent and the objective facts about the human person or human nature or human goodness, right? And, you know, for Aristotle in the Ethics, that's his focus, objective facts about human nature and human goodness, right? That's what he thinks you're interested in, because it's only when you possess that that we would call you happy, right? So it's not a kind of subjectivism. And these two flaws that I'm pointing out, you know, for Aristotle, the two flaws are going to be related in terms of there being flaws. So for Aristotle, fundamentally, what a human being is a rational, social, political animal. And so if that's the kind of thing that we are, then our happiness has to be understood in terms of common goods and shared forms of life. So for Aristotle, I think it's true to say that the happy life is a life of friendship. It is a life, right, that is well lived in communion with others and in no other way. So if that's true, then theories that understand happiness solely in terms of an individual's subjective condition are disconnected from this reality about human persons, right? The reality that they have these objective conditions for their flourishing, namely that they have to form a community of persons with other people. So for Aristotle, you might feel really good about your life. You might be in a good mood. You might have an overall balance of pleasure and pain. And still be failing miserably to flourish objectively as a human being. And that's what he really cares about. And he thinks about it in terms of the highest good. Now, it is true that there is a subjective component to happiness, right? So presumably someone living you diamond life will feel good or satisfied about their life, but only insofar as they meet this objective criteria for flourishing. So happiness is about living and being in a certain way and not just about feeling a certain way. So I just want to be clear about that. That's what we mean by happiness. Okay, so happiness, as I said, or eudaimonia or flourishing, whatever you want to call it, it's essentially connected to virtue. So what does virtue mean for Aristotle? Virtue is a settled, stable disposition. It's a kind of existential readiness or preparedness to think, feel, and act in ways that conduce to objective flourishing for human beings, in ways that constitute a happy and good life. So the master virtue for Aristotle is practical wisdom or phronesis, and this is just good judgment about what to do in the particular circumstances of your life. Now, Aristotle recognizes that having this good judgment is actually really hard. It's not like you might be born naturally, like really clever or smart, but nobody's naturally born practically wise. It's something that you have to be habituated into, and it takes a lot of experience, and you have to have an example of a wise person that you can imitate and follow. But he also thinks that there's no way you can be practically wise without moral virtue. So practical wisdom is an intellectual virtue. It perfects the practical intellect, which is the mode of thinking and reasoning and knowing in relation to choice and action. But there's also moral virtue. And moral virtue is the regulation of our appetites or our desires. So there are lower appetites. There's like fear and our appetites for food and sex and drink and things like this. that's all the stuff of moral virtue, but there's also what Aristotle calls boulesis, which is sometimes translated as the will. And that is the stuff of justice, right? Decision, and performing just acts. So these are all moral virtues because what they perfect is our appetites. And Aristotle thinks you just can't make good practical judgments without moral virtue. That is to say, without right desire. Because he thinks that if you have disordered desires or unregulated desires, then you'll be unable to read a situation clearly, because one of the things that disordered desires does in us is it misdirects our attention, right? And so we're not able to pick out what features of the situation are salient. Another thing about virtue to say is that it's a mean, right? It's a mean between two extremes. So if you think about courage, courage is the virtue that regulates our fears. Fears are something that we naturally experience as human beings. But if we have courage, that means that we're neither a coward nor a bore, right? So we feel the right amount of fear in the appropriate circumstances. Temperance regulates our bodily desires for sensual pleasures so that we're neither prudes nor profligates. And justice makes us ready to act in ways that respects the rights of others, to give others what is owed to them. Nobody's born virtuous, right? You can only become virtuous through a certain kind of education. It takes many years. And it takes a certain kind of training and inculcation, and it also takes a desire to be virtuous. But if you do become a virtuous person, then you're like all set to live well. Now, virtue, however, is not, it's necessary, but it's not sufficient for living well. So Aristotle also thinks that you need external goods in order to live a happy life. So for Aristotle, there's like a certain amount of luck or good fortune that's involved in attaining the happy life as he understands it, because he thinks, rightly or wrongly, in order to live well, you also have to have a modicum of wealth. You have to have health. He thinks you should not be ugly. he thinks, you know, you have to be born in a decent society. And happily for him, he's a Greek. But maybe you're a barbarian. And that's just too bad for you. The world needs to also do you a favor. And I mention that because friendship is, for Aristotle, an external good. Just like keep that in the back of your head when you're thinking about him. As the Nicomachean Ethics progresses, and it's 10 books in total, we kind of see Aristotle working his way up to the highest good. So actually the way that the Nicomachean Ethics proceeds, the form matches the content. So it's no surprise that it opens up with the question of the highest good, and then it ends with the answer. It's contemplation of God, by the way. So it's a kind of progression, and he begins with moral virtues, and he works his way up to intellectual virtues, and then he finally gets to friendship in books 8 and 9. So it's pretty late on the scene. The only book that comes after that is on contemplation of God. Which is the highest good. And so one of the questions that we want to try to answer at the end of this is, how does the active life, the life of friendship, fit in with the contemplative life? Okay, so here's how Aristotle opens up book 8 of the Nicomachean Ethics. He says, no one would choose to live without friends, even if he had all other good things. No one would choose to live without friends. So he's literally saying a life without friends isn't choice-worthy, and no one would choose it. He says at other times that, you know, friendship is absolutely essential to the good life. But I think this is really striking, because he says, even if he had every other good thing, his life wouldn't be choice-worthy if he didn't have friends. So this is like signaling just how important this is. And remember, this comes after he's already enumerated all the virtues. That's all done. And now he's just saying, A life without friends isn't choice-worthy. So what is friendship for Aristotle? And mostly here, I'm going to focus on what he says in Book 8. So in its most basic generic sense, for Aristotle, friendship is a kind of reciprocal goodwill between two persons, so they will one another's good, and these two persons seek to live one life together. So that's really important. So it's not just that it's not just like, oh, you know, I want the good for you and you want the good for me, but also we want to live life together. This friendship requires mutual affection and like-mindedness, and Aristotle insists that it depends on a certain sort of equality between its participants. So I can't be friends with a bottle of wine, as much as I might love wine. I can't be friends with a horse. I also can't be friends with someone who's so unequal to me in terms of abilities or capacities that I can't imagine spending huge chunks of my life with them. So there has to be a kind of equality. And the inequality can go in either direction. Like someone could just be far too superior for me to be their friend, or they could be far too inferior to me. But there has to be equality because friendship is living, acting, and thinking in a cooperative way. Friendship is a kind of love, okay? We should like freely adopt this language of love. It's a kind of love. And for Aristotle, when we're thinking about friendship and what it means to will the good for another person in this mutual way, we're always talking about the good, right? Because love is, right, it's desire for the good. And Aristotle thinks of the good as having three different aspects. And so he thinks there are three different kinds of friendships that you find in human life. And these friendships track the three different kind of characteristic forms of attractiveness of the good or something like that. So that is pleasure, utility, and virtue. So the three kinds of friendship then are friendships of pleasure, friendships of utility, and virtuous friendships, or friendships of excellence, as it's sometimes translated. So it's because there are these three objects of love that there are these three kinds of friendship. So let's just start with friendships of pleasure. What's the ground of the affection and the basis of the shared life in this kind of friendship? Aristotle says it's the pleasure they get in participating in certain activities together. So think of your drinking buddy or the people you like to party with, or maybe just, I don't know, like maybe you like to sew or something. And so there are just people who also enjoy these activities, and you get together and you do this kind of stuff with them, and that's the ground of your friendship. But you can imagine like, and a lot of college friendships actually end this way. It's like one of the guys gets married and suddenly he can't be at the bar all the time with the rest of his buddies. And the friendship, you know, these people drift apart because the basis of the friendship was really the pleasure that they had in drinking together, you know, or throwing darts or whatever they did at the bar. Now, you might still have mutual affection for these people. You might still wish them well, but you no longer really desire to like spend all your time with them. So these friendships of pleasure, once the basis of the pleasure is gone, the reason for the friendship is gone. And Aristotle says that these sorts of friendships are most characteristic of young people who tend to act from passion and to seek pleasure. And he thinks they're the most unstable, like least interesting. They're like the least valuable kind of friendship that you could have, but it's still a real friendship. Okay, it's not like an ersatz friendship, it's real friendship. And then the second kind of friendship is friendship of utility. So these friendships are grounded in the instrumental value the relationship is bringing to both of its participants. So these are people who love each other, or they have this mutual affection for one another, but it's based on what is useful to them, and it's not based on a love of the person for themselves. So I was like thinking about what are my utility friendships? And the best example I could think of was when I was in college, there was a guy who was in my Latin class and in my calculus class. And so we used to study together all the time. And it was mutually beneficial because I was much better in Latin than he was, and he was much better in calculus than I was. So we would get together and I would help him with Latin, he would help me with calculus, and like we were friends, you know, like we would study and then like we would get something to eat, or maybe, I don't know, like maybe we would do something else, but we were friends. But once, you know, once Latin was over and once, especially once calculus was over for me, there just really wasn't that much of a basis for this friendship. You know, like he was a nice guy, but we didn't have that much in common and we drifted apart. I can't even remember his name. So this is like a classic friendship of utility, right? You have goodwill, you have mutual affection, you have these shared activities that you do together. But it really is based on this person's usefulness to you and your usefulness to them. Again, Aristotle wants to insist this is like a real kind of friendship, you know? It's not like it's bad, but this isn't the essence of a happy life. This is what he says about these two kinds of friendship. He says, these friendships are friendships incidentally. For the one loved is not loved by reference to the person he is, but to the fact that in one case he provides some good and in the other some pleasure. Such friendships are easily dissolved. And then he contrasts this kind of friendship with the friendship between excellent people, or the friendships between virtuous people. And this is the most important sort of friendship, the kind that's really at the heart of a happy life. And here, the ground of the mutual love and affection is the friends, right? So in this kind of friendship, you love the friend for who they are. So this is what Aristotle says. This is another quote. It is the friendship between excellent people or virtuous people resembling one another in excellence that is complete. For each alike of these wishes good things for the other insofar as he is good, and he is good in himself. And those who wish good things for their friends' sake, are friends most of all. For they do so because of the friends themselves and not incidentally. So these friendships are very stable and lasting because what is loved is the excellence of the friend, in particular, the excellent character of the friend. So it's not that you love like their physical beauty or their charm, but you love their good character. And Aristotle notices, and this is very important, that these excellent friendships are also pleasant and useful. So there's a kind of unity to the good that he's bringing out in his discussion of friendship. So when you hit on what is truly good in itself, that thing is also pleasing to you and beneficial to you, useful to you, but your attraction to it is just that it's good. So whereas the other sorts of friendships only get like one aspect of the good and not the others, in excellent friendships, you get the entirety of the good. And that's another reason why for Aristotle, they're so excellent. Aristotle says that these kinds of friendships are rare and precious because they require time and attention and trust. He thinks that such friendships are the occasion for growth in virtue and also the exercise of virtue. Aristotle is really clear that it is the loving reciprocal good that is what is most excellent about these friendships. So the flourishing life then is one of loving communion with another person in this specific sense. The other thing that I want to note as important for Aristotle is that friendship is a common good. So there are three important features of common goods for Aristotle. The first is that these goods are common to all human beings. So the common ground of them is in human nature. There's like a metaphysical common ground. Second, these goods are not competitive. So my pursuit of a common good in no way in no way detracts or takes away from anyone else's pursuit of it. And third, if it's truly a common good, then it's never the sole possession of an individual. And it could never be measured just by looking at an individual, because the enjoyment of the good only comes through activities, shared activities, in which others also participate, such that the good is brought about and enjoyed together. And that's really crucial. So the example that I always use to think about this is like a symphony. So if you think about a symphony, you have all of these different players and singers who have to cooperatively work together, both to bring the symphony into being and also to be able to enjoy it, right? I mean, like if I'm thinking of a French horn player, like he can play his part, but he can't play Beethoven's Ninth, right? The only way to play Beethoven's Ninth is to get with the whole orchestra and bring it into being. And that's when playing his part is truly enjoyable, right? And so that's kind of like a common good. So this idea of friendship as a common good, as a communion of persons, I think is fitting with Aristotle's idea of happiness as a natural good, because again, we're rational and political animals. We use language to communicate and make laws. So it makes sense that the happy life, the kind of life that realizes our potential as the kind of thing that we are, would be had in communion with other persons that's based in a kind of mutual affection and love. I'll also just note that in Aristotle's discussions of friendship, he talks about like almost all loving relationships as kinds of friendship. So the relationship between a mother, between parents and their children, between spouses. He even talks about the relationships between neighbors and citizens as kinds of friendship. So he thinks all of this is really important in human life, but he thinks that these character friendships are the most essential in terms of human flourishing. Okay, Aristotle also discusses the virtue of friendliness or affability as a specific virtue. It's a virtue that's necessary for good discourse and social relations. It's basically a mean between, you don't want to be obsequious or a flatterer, but you also don't want to be like rude and aggressive. So if you have the virtue of friendliness, which he thinks of as a moral virtue, then you're the kind of person who can make social situations go smoothly, right? So you're able to put people at ease. You're able to make people feel comfortable. And Aristotle thinks this is actually a really critical virtue. But like all virtues, it requires wisdom. And it requires all of the other virtues. So like you couldn't put someone at ease by flattering them, by telling them things about themselves that aren't true. So you would need to be honest and things like this. But friendliness or affability or amicability is also a virtue for Aristotle. And I think that's important because, again, it just underscores how important the common life is in his conception of ethics. Aristotle makes some interesting remarks about friendship and justice. So he says that the just need friends, but friends don't need justice. What on earth does he mean by this? Basically, I think it goes back to this idea that there's a kind of progression in the Nicomachean ethics. So if you think how it proceeds, you have moral virtue. The highest moral virtue is justice. That's book 5. And justice is the habit of giving to other people what is owed to them. And then after that, you have practical wisdom. And then after that, you have friendship. So you have this idea that justice is kind of the soil in which friendships grow. But friends don't need justice. Why not? Well, it's not because you can lie and steal to your friends. That's not what Aristotle's saying. He's saying that the kind of loving relationship that is friendship makes justice unnecessary. So if you think about what it means to give somebody what they're owed, right? You just need to respect them as a person who has rights, and in whom you stand in certain relations of obligation. So it's a kind of I-thou, I-you relationship, right? It's essentially interpersonal, but it's not necessarily loving, right? you just have to treat people with respect and give them what's owed to them, and that's it. But friendship is something much higher than that. And I think that we can come to understand why friends don't need justice if we think about what Aristotle means when he says that a friend is a second self. So this is like a famous Aristotelian slogan. A friend is a second self. What does it mean? I think it means this. In friendship, you take the good of the friend as an essential part of your own good, such that the friend's happiness becomes your happiness. It just becomes a part of your own happiness. So if we think of the happiness of the friend as a common good in which both friends participate, then we're not in competition with our friends, right? What the friend wants for himself, his happiness, is not a private good, right? In competition with the friend's good. He wants it to be something shared in a reciprocal way with the friend, right? So friendship involves a kind of self-transcendent perspective in which one sees one's own life and one's good in relation to this greater whole, that is, this communion of persons that has been brought into being. So a friend understands himself as a part, in the sense of a participant, in a union of affection and will with another person. And now, insofar as you're taking up this perspective, it's not that like we're competing about something or like your happiness detracts from mine. It's more like if my friend suffers, I suffer, right? If my friend is flourishing, I'm flourishing, because obviously I don't do that independently of my friend. And now if we think about this stuff about justice, like if I'm your friend, I'm going to return your laptop that I borrowed, but I'm not going to return it because I owe it to you, even though I do owe it to you. And I'm not going to do it out of respect for you, even though I do respect you. But I'm going to do it because it's good for us. It's good for us, this communion of persons. And I'm going to do it because I love us, right? I mean, I love you. Like, that's the basis of this communion of persons. But like, really what I love is us, right? I love our friendship. And that's why I'm going to return your laptop. So I think it's sort of like this sense. I mean, this is something like what Aristotle means when he says that, friends don't need justice. They've transcended it. Like they're on some kind of higher plane. And there's an Aristotle scholar that I really think is excellent named Arya Kosman. And he talks about this a lot. He talks about the friend, friendship as an enlarging or enhancing your self-consciousness, your being, like kind of your being in the world. And he says that friends form like a we subject. So it's no longer I, thou, but it's we, right? It's the first person plural. And he says, friends, they have this shared vision and pursuit of a common good, so that it's no longer just like somebody's subjective being that's enhanced or enlarged in friendship, but actually because friends kind of co-perceive reality and they think together and they speak together and they act together, they acquire a wider, deeper, more powerful range of objective conscious life. So through friendship, and here I'm quoting Kosman because I think it's great, the enhancement of my being is not simply as subject, but as objectively determined consciousness. And this is accomplished by the richer field of objective being made possible by political life, that is to say, the life of friendship. So friends enlarge their being by enabling each other to intelligibly encounter a wider field of reality, right? So I think this is worth thinking about. I'm going to keep going, but it's worth thinking about what that really means, and how that cuts against a certain kind of subjective picture of happiness. I'll also note that Aristotle thinks of conversation as like the paradigm of this sort of enrichment or enlargement of the self. Okay, so So the last thing that I guess I'll say is this kind of self-transcendence that you achieve within friendship. It's not a selflessness. It's not like altruism. It's not about forgetting the self. But it's more about transcending a more enclosed mode of selfhood for the sake of a higher, more expansive mode of selfhood. So the love of friends is neither self-regarding rather than other-regarding, and it's not other-regarding rather than self-regarding. It's rather that the regard for the self now necessarily includes regard for the other. So, right, it's not I, thou, it's a we. Okay, so I also want to say something about the contemplative life being a life of friendship, because I think this is especially important for students, you know, for undergrads, for students, well, actually for grad students too. This is important for you. I shouldn't leave you out. You know, Aristotle goes on to say that contemplation, specifically contemplation of God, is the highest human activity. That sounds like something, you know, that you do by yourself. But actually, Aristotle thinks that this activity is like most enjoyable when you do it with friends. And if you think about the context of the sort of friendships that you can have in college, this shared form of life where you are trying to understand what is true together, I think is for Aristotle one of the ways of living the contemplative life. So if you think of St. Thomas and his discussions of studiositas, right? I mean, this is a virtue that you can really cultivate with your friends and exercise with your friends. So we don't need to think of the contemplative life and the active life as opposed to one another. We can think of our contemplative lives as a kind of friendship. And in fact, I encourage you to think of it that way. Okay, so now I have to get to Aquinas because it's already 8:45 and I don't know how that happened. So Aquinas basically follows Aristotle in thinking that the blessed or the happy life requires virtue. But he makes a bunch of distinctions that Aristotle is not going to make. And it's important to understanding these distinctions to see how his view of friendship and virtue is going to be different. So the first distinction that St. Thomas makes that Aristotle doesn't is between imperfect and perfect happiness. So imperfect happiness for St. Thomas is what we can have in this earthly life, and it requires what Aquinas calls natural virtues. Natural virtues are basically the Aristotelian virtues. And these virtues are necessary to attain what Aquinas calls our natural end. And Aquinas does distinguish, metaphysically, between our natural end and our supernatural end. And he just thinks that our natural end is ultimately ordered to our supernatural end. Aristotle doesn't think we have a supernatural end. So this is not like, not something that he's messing with. Now, Aquinas thinks we're not perfectly happy in this life because no created good can completely satisfy us as rational creatures. So because we're rational creatures, we seek to know the truth and love what is good and what is beautiful. But these ends are never exhausted by anything finite or created. So we're always, I don't know, we're always just kind of dissatisfied. It's like read Augustine, think about your restless heart. I mean, none of the great things that we get in this life fully, completely satisfy us, even though they might be really great, including our friendships. For Thomas, they're like no earthly friendship or romance. I mean, like, I don't care how great your marriage is or whatever. None of that's going to perfectly fulfill you. And yeah, so our perfect beatitude or our perfect happiness consists in beholding God as he is in his essence, or the beatific vision. We cannot do this in this life, St. Thomas thinks, and we certainly can't do it just through natural virtue, right? So like justice and practical wisdom is not going to get us the beatific vision. So the goods we enjoy in this life are a foretaste of our perfect good or our beatitude. And Aquinas argues that there are also theological virtues that direct us to eternal life with God. And of course, Aristotle has no conception of this, but these are faith, hope, and love. The theological virtues come about through us, through the operation of divine grace. We do not become hopeful in the same way that we would become just or temperate. We have to cooperate with divine grace. We follow the promptings of the Holy Spirit. We can't acquire these virtues through our own steam. Faith for Aquinas perfects our intellect. Hope and love perfects our will. Now, it's within this context, right? It's like an Aristotelian framework, but it's expanded. And it's within this context that Aquinas discusses friendship with God, right? So if you think of the Secunda Secundae, question 23, the first question on charity, one of the first things that he says is that it's a kind of friendship. Now, this is a big, big, big difference with Aristotle, because Aristotle insists that friendship with God is impossible. Why? Well, remember, for Aristotle, true friendship depends on a certain amount of equality, right? And Aristotle's God is just far too superior to any human being to be friends with them, right? Aristotle's God can't be friends with humans because there's like no common good that they could share. There's no way for them to communicate or share their lives in any relevant sense. And so there's no basis for like this good mutual goodwill. And, you know, also Aristotle's God is just thought, thinking, thought. So it doesn't, you know, Aristotle's God doesn't love you. And he certainly doesn't need to have a friendship with you so he could like exercise his virtue with you. Like that just fundamentally makes no sense. So how is it that Aquinas thinks we can be friends with God? Well, I mean, the first thing that you need to say is that really to understand what Aquinas says here, you have to leave the philosophical mode and enter the theological mode. And that means that you're not going to get to this conclusion just through the use of natural reason. And Thomas doesn't. He relies explicitly on scripture and revelation, you know, to make sense of this. So he's not just being a philosopher and saying this. But this is what he says in the relevant bit of the Summa that I just mentioned. So he says, according to the philosopher, which of course is Aristotle, not every love has the character of friendship, but that love which is together with benevolence, when to wit we love someone so as to wish good to him. If, however, we do not wish good to what we love, but wish its good for ourselves, thus we are said to love wine or a horse, it is not love of friendship, but a kind of concupiscence, a love of concupiscence. For it would be absurd to speak of having friendship for wine or for a horse. Yet neither does well-wishing suffice for friendship, for a certain mutual love is requisite, since friendship is between friend and friend, and this is well-wishing, and it's founded on some kind of communicatio. Accordingly, since there is a communicatio between man and God, inasmuch as he communicates his happiness to us, some kind of friendship must be based on this same communicatio of which it is written in 1 Corinthians 1:9, God is faithful, by whom you are called unto the fellowship of his Son. The love which is based on this communicatio is caritas, where it is evidence that caritas is the friendship of man for God. So really quickly, how do we make sense of this? Here's what I think that it means. God communicates his happiness to us by making us in his image, first and foremost. Only rational creatures, according to Aquinas, can attain the sort of communion with God that is the beatific vision. Okay, so your dog's not going to be beatified, sorry. Aquinas' God, unlike Aristotle's God, is a creator, and he made man in his own image and likeness, and he made man for himself as a thing to be perfected in communion with him. God did not have to create man. He didn't need us. He didn't have to create anything. He didn't need anything. All of creation is a gratuitous gesture of love, a communication of his goodness. And this is the basis, the communicatio, this is the basis of the friendship of man for God. And of course, we know that God became man in the person of Jesus Christ and dwelt among us to reveal himself to us and to enact the work of our salvation. These are truths that Aquinas has by faith and that for Aristotle would seem pretty wild, if not downright perverse. So that's how I think you end up having friendship with God for Aquinas. And I'll also just say that Aquinas thinks that conversation with God, the sort of intimate conversation with God that we have in prayer, is a foretaste of the friendship with God that we will have, that is our perfect happiness. So he makes some really interesting remarks in his commentary on Job to this effect. Okay, so final thought. So if we think about the kinds of friendships, you know, this, if we think about friendship in this Aristotelian sense and the sorts of friendships that we ought to be making now in our lives, I think that as Christians, you know, you always need to make room for friendships that help us to grow in our love of Christ. So I certainly have many non-Christian friends, and I value those friendships really dearly. Some of my closest friends are not Christians. In fact, they're atheists. But I also think that there's a certain limitation to these friendships, and that we do not share a common vision of where our happiness lies, right? And if we think of friendship as being predicated upon, as it's being a common good and predicated upon a common vision of what that good is, then any extent to which there is, you know, a pretty big digression there is a limitation on the friendship necessarily. It doesn't make it not a true friendship. That's not what I'm saying. But I think it does suggest that it is a limitation, and that our deepest friendships will be with those who share a vision of where our common good lies, right? And so our deepest friendships ought to consist in activities aimed at this highest common good, which of course is our eternal life with God.